Why is business such a snowflake? Executives chewing million-euro deals for breakfast and spitting out ministers like grape pips for lunch. Before a few lines of coke on the water closet, you'd expect that tough skin to hold true when questioned about their ethics and political motivations. No, they fall apart. They don't like it. Politics has nothing to do with business, they declare. Really? Business is about professionalism and politics is the game of personal opinions and emotions and has no place in this office, they scream, going red, suppressing somehow an enormous urge to continue the rant by thinking of the next product they're going to buy, made presumably from the components mined by children the age of 7. He can be emotional, but not the people who disagree with him. That is the kind of professionalism he likes. In this episode, inspired by a post I saw on LinkedIn by Judith S., shout out to Judith, Eshru and I talk about exactly how close business and politics really are, and indeed have always been. The two are inseparable because politicians need money to make the country work. The question is usually where to get the money from. Taxing poor people is easy as they don't usually have any means of response. They can't afford proper legal representation and unions have been battered down as far as is possible. On top of that, protesting is difficult to organise. Taxing the rich won't work because rich business people funded their election campaigns and so we can't have that. In recent days, Republican senators have stated publicly that they are afraid to speak against the president because there are consequences to speaking out. Can someone just hold that thought a moment and consider the depth of that statement? Thanks again to my good friend and political activist Eshru for your time. It's always a pleasure and always insightful to speak with you. Turn a mic, no longer clocking out. Rise up.
Jepek kudwelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod joke mawoy etu under mic. Seche tim sudbuta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed ping biwawinje erochako domomet ndi podcast makende.
I'm joined once again by my good friend and activist, Eshru. Eshru, how's it going?
Good morning, good morning. Love to see you, Zach. I'm good. I'm really good. Thanks for having me once again.
Yeah. It's, you know, I was kind of looking at our previous podcast, and it's been a long time since we actually recorded one. But just so that people know, we actually stay in touch pretty regularly. And your political output is not limited to this podcast, and you are extremely active on other platforms, and we'll put in some of your links so that people can follow you there as well. But it has been a long time since we've spoken about these things.
Absolutely, and like you say, yeah, we have been in touch. I mean, we have even met in London, but yeah, it has been some time since we've had this discussion, even though it's at the forefront of our mind. But life gets in the way, hey.
Definitely does. And also, yeah, the capacity that you and I have for being active is never limited to these discussions. So we're going to talk about some of the things that you've posted today. And this morning I was looking through my LinkedIn, and I have to say I was kind of inspired a little bit by a lady called Judith on LinkedIn. And the main point that she made was, don't expect me to stay silent just so you can stay comfortable, all right? And the first paragraph of a post was this, if you just allow me the moment. It's remarkable how some people seem more concerned about how a platform is used than about a 24/7 live-streamed genocide. Even more remarkable is that they choose to publicly police others for using their voice here instead of showing any concern for the thousands of professionals from Gaza who were on this platform but could no longer log in because they've been murdered, starved, or buried under rubble along with their families. What are your immediate thoughts to that?
Well, the first line of that paragraph resonates with me because it's something I often spoke about when I was on X, formerly Twitter, when people came at me for putting up content that they didn't agree with. I used to say that I'm not here to manage your feelings. I'm not here to make you feel comfortable. These are the facts. Manage your own feelings. And as you say, when you look at LinkedIn, it's a platform for business. A lot of people are upset about it being used to push certain content, but let's remember that a lot of business is still doing business with brutal regimes around the world. So you can't really separate the two. If we're going to use this platform to be pushing certain business, then maybe we should be highlighting some of the wrongs, you know, that some of these companies are doing, or at least some of the injustices that we witness around the world, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the points which come to mind as well, is recently it's been brought to the fore the role that Microsoft has played in what's been going on in Gaza. If I'm not mistaken, Ibtihal Abu Saad, who made comments about what Microsoft was doing on their 50th anniversary event, was fired. And another protester, Vania Agrawal, was also fired for interrupting some of the senior people at Microsoft. So, and Microsoft has sold products which have been used, unfortunately, in very tragic ways in Gaza. So therefore, I mean, surely there's a legitimate reason for people highlighting these issues on business platforms.
Absolutely. But, you know, what I've learned is certainly in these last couple of years, people do not like a mirror being held up to show them who they are. This is what they don't like. And these are large organizations, okay? People like the people that run these corporations probably won't get touched. A lot of these people, we don't even know many of who these people are. But I think everyday people kind of feel somewhat partly responsible because they're thinking, well, I'm not doing anything to help the cause. And in some way, deep down, they know what is being done is right. But because they have no way of dealing with it, they push back. Do you understand me?
Absolutely.
And also, it's that having that mirror held up. People can't take that. And let's remember, we live in a world where everything that the people who run this part of the world has done is correct, it's fair, it's just. There's always been a good intent behind it, in air quotes for those that can't see. And now the tables turned, the internet, social media has allowed those of us who have been voiceless, those of us who have not been able to, that has had little power in politics, it's given us a platform to be able to tell you the rest of the world how we view the world, how we experience the world. And all of a sudden the world is like, whoa, this is too much for us. I can't deal with it. So, of course, you get the backlash or people don't think it's a good thing, it's a good idea. Well, it's not a good idea for us to remain quiet either. We've been quiet for too long. This all happening, what's happening in Gaza has been going on since 1948, if memory serves correctly, started by the British once again. Wherever we go in this world, wherever there is turmoil, the British are at the start of it. And we don't talk about that. It's literally they've expunged that part of history. It's October the 7th. It started way before then. We never spoke about it. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, indeed. And the British and their, shall we say, competition with the French, unfortunately, shaped the way that the Middle East is today. And I mean, the British influence there goes back a lot further. I mean, the Dutch were also involved in some of those areas. Many European powers, unfortunately. But bringing it back to this discussion about business and exactly what you're saying there. It's another form of keeping the protests or the demonstrations or the political activists silent by limiting the type of topics that we can talk about on a business platform. Essentially tells people that you don't have a place here. But when we look at some of these businesses which have been conducted over the last, you know, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more, but as we mentioned it before, the slave trade, quite clearly a business term, the East India Company and what they went out there to achieve. The Nazis in their concentration camps essentially using the Jewish people there to man their factories. And when they were no longer useful to them, exterminated in the most horrific ways. And we could also extend that to the US incarceration system, which is essentially being used to provide them with extremely cheap labor too.
Exactly. I think what people need to realize is the way that things are being spun, it's being spun as if it's all new. But those who have been paying attention know that this is just a continuation of what has gone before. As you say, they used exploitative methods for the slave trade. They've been exploiting people. Used prison labor to exploit, you know, the cheapest possible source, of course, maximum profits. This is how it's always been done. When we see what's happening in Israel, it isn't anything new. How do you think the British established Australia and New Zealand? How did it go on in India? They slaughtered, from the book that I've read called Exterminate All Them Brutes by Sven Lindqvist. I believe you're going to put that in the link below. They slaughtered in 100 years close to around 80 million Africans just on the continent alone, from the moment they arrived. The Europeans, not just the British, it was the Portuguese, the Germans, literally. And there's a time elapsed map on this, literally the slaughter. And then they went to the Americas and did exactly the same thing. And what we're witnessing today in Israel and the Middle East, it's the same. It's just a continuation. Times change, methods may change, you may give it another name, but it's about dominating, exterminating a group of people and dominating a region that they come from. Same process. Yeah,
indeed. And the thing is that people just for some reason believe this is a question of good versus evil. The good is always the side where you are, of course. But what people fail to see is actually the reason why most of these wars are fought is to in some way gain possession of natural resources. And natural resources is a business issue.
Absolutely. If not natural resources, it's to a geographical, a region or location. But yeah, it's a business. This is what it comes down to and nothing else. One thing with the West is this. It has to have a monetary value attached, okay, to absolutely everything that it does. And I'm reading this really good book right about now called The Dark Laboratory by Tao Li Goff. On Columbus, the Caribbean, and the origins of the climate crisis. Let me start at the beginning. She's sat in a classroom. She studied quite high up. I urge anybody listening to this to read the book. So she studied quite high up at Harvard or one of these top institutions. And a guest speaker comes in and takes a couple of lectures, and it's Tony Blair. Tony Blair asks a question, when did globalization start? And the usual answers came back after people threw their hands up, the 1950s and 1960s. And she says, well, surely it started in the 1600s with the enslavement of my people. Class went quiet, teacher moved on. And what she goes on to say in this book is that Western societies have never, ever respected environments. They've never respected the culture and of indigenous people. Everything that they see has to be plundered and a monetary value attached to it. And how much they can get from it and how much money they can make from it. And once they've consumed this or technology's moved on, they move on to the next thing. Just like slavery, people will tell you that the British ended slavery out of the goodness of their heart. No, it was a combination of two things. First of all, they couldn't handle the slaves after a while. The slaves became stronger and they fought back many times and the British lost in many battles. But automation was the next thing. It no longer became profitable. And the entire time that they were working out the slave owners' compensation pay, discussions were being spoken about new technology that was coming about where that money could be invested into. So it wasn't just about, you know, ending slavery and the slaves disappearing into society and you getting paid. That money was then invested for future generations. So there's always a monetary value attached to the exploitation that they can manufacture for themselves. And we're witnessing it here today in where, you know, how we're living today. I mean, people are working for peanuts. The exploitation continues, just in a more civil way.
Yeah, indeed. And it's also quite interesting where, with regards to what Trump is talking about with regards to his tariffs, I would love it if, I don't know, 100 million Americans started screwing together Apple iPhones. Because as a, and this isn't my intelligence, as a lot of people online have observed, yeah, watch the price of iPhones jump to, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000
easily. I listened to a guy called Victor Gao, Chinese, and he was being interviewed on Channel 4. And the broadcaster, I can't remember her name escapes me. She says to him, he says, Americans should understand who China are. And he says, we don't care. She says, yeah, but America's 50% of the Chinese, you know, she has this, she still thinks that the universe is centered around America and Europeanness, but America's 15% huge rate. He says, we've been around for 5,000 years, a lot longer than America's existed, and we've done all right, and we've done pretty well now. So we don't care about America. Let them continue. And I love the delivery on that. We've been here for 5,000 years. How long has America been around? 200 plus years? Or yeah. Whatever, 400 years? Not very long.
No, absolutely not. I have to say, I find that very enlightening. I enjoyed the clip that you sent me. It also, I read a tweet yesterday or the day before by somebody, and they also commented on the European Union is now negotiating to reduce trade barriers to be able to import Chinese electric vehicles. This is a really bad move from the US. And I responded to that. And my response essentially was that, why does everything the European Union does have to be considered from the US perspective? I, as a European, couldn't give a damn what the White House thinks. The European Union, the European countries, have to do whatever they think is best for their own people. We know that in the past that hasn't been the case. And we also know that even now the EU has a lot of corrupt politicians, and I'm not saying that they are whatever. But if the European Union finally starts to behave properly and starts to open up and have sincere and respectful trade relations with other parts of the world, I really couldn't give a damn what the White House says.
You know, I think one of the problems is after the Cold War ended, and I say ended because I don't like saying the US won the Cold War, I just say it ended. The US claimed to be, you know, the world superpower, the number one in the world. And everybody seems to want to look towards America. The world needs a leader. You often hear this in the news being repeated in Britain. The world needs a leader. The world needs a leader. You often hear this. And I thought to myself, well, why does America have to be that leader? Why does the world need a leader? We live in a world where climate conference, the very countries that are going to be affected most by the climate conference are never invited to the table for discussions. Their opinions are never considered. We will never see the showcasing of, you know, the countries that do the most polluting and the most exploiting in the world. And that's the countries from the north, the Britain, America, and Europe, okay? We'll never see anything from the south. Maybe a little bit in the east, but nothing from the global south. And these people are going to suffer the most. Why do we need a country that does the most exploiting and does the least to ensure that the climate is protected? Why should we have them as the world leader? Let's not even talk about the carbon footprint that the weapons manufacturing industry and war creates. Just that alone. But they want me and you to stop eating steak, because that's causing a problem. You know, sometimes you think to yourself, are these people for real? But I think a lot of it as well is conditioning. They like to condition people. And this is why you keep hearing them say, the world needs a leader. I've heard so many journalists and broadcasters say the same thing. The world needs a leader. The world, we look to America as the world. Why? I don't see America as a leader. I don't see them as a leader. I don't see it as a leader. Sorry, the US, I've got to get this right. My friends in South America keep telling me, it's the US. America is all of it. So I must remember, I don't look at the US as a world leader. I don't.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, just on the one point, I think it's always good to eat less steak, purely because of the way that the actual industry is unfortunately managed. But I agree. And and also an observation, because you said before that a little bit is in the east. I mean, India and China do have substantial carbon footprints. A lot of people don't realize, though, that that's because Europe and the USA has exported its carbon consumption to these nations. So there is a lot of unfortunately CO2 production in those countries, but there's a substantial reason why that is heavily influenced by business as well.
Absolutely, but I think the point I was making, I should have made myself clear, I was trying to say that the people who are those who are being left out of the discussion are those countries who are being affected the most. Let's hear what they have to say. Maybe they have. When I look at what's going on online, sometimes you see some of the most amazing things happening in parts of South America and Africa, and you think, why is at least this person a trillionaire doing? You know, why isn't this person's product an idea? Why is it not the forefront? And you think about all these other people out there in this part of the world that's doing the same thing. Let's bring them to the table so we can hear what they have to say about fighting. You know, learning about how we're going to, you know, make some of the meet some of the challenges that we have for the future of humanity.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Instead of you know, excluding them from the discussions.
Yep. Now, I do remember just to, you know, one example. I remember reading an article about a young man who had used waste essentially that had been either exported to his nation or that he had found on the beach. But basically, he started building renewable energy facilities that people can put on their roofs,
yes,
which they can use to charge batteries, so that they could have light and power in his very, very poor village.
Yeah,
and just fantastic innovation.
There was that's one, and I've seen one where there's a lady, I'm not sure which part of West or East Africa, she was using waste plastic materials to make bricks. And they were molding in a machine, and these bricks then would be able to be used to build, you know, whatever. And the way that she was treating the bricks, they were being treated in such a way that they couldn't burn, so that it wasn't a fire risk. And I thought the same thing to myself, look at this. So brilliant. Why aren't these ideas being adopted? But again, we live in a world where it's only discovered when a white person does it. And that's how it is. Just how the world is.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there is far too much truth to that very simple statement.
No disrespect to my white listeners. I'm just saying this is how the world has been formed. I'm just speaking honestly.
Yeah. Which does actually bring us back to one of the original points behind why we were having this discussion in the first place. So we've established a business perspective, and we've established that there is a very definite link between business and political motivations, business and political intentions and strategies. Now, you are currently doing a five-part post series on Substack, and I'm going to put a link to your account, obviously, in the podcast notes. So far, you've produced two of the five. So the third one, I think you said, is going to come out on Monday. So people should look out for that. The first one, if you could just give a quick synopsis of the two. So the first one is called The Womb of Exploitation.
That is correct. The Womb of Exploitation. What motivated me to write this is I was sat here thinking about generational trauma that people suffer that you never deal with. Some of it you do, but not all. And it was off the back of that TV series that came off Netflix called Adolescence and the incel culture and toxic masculinity and stuff like that. And John Amici, the former basketball and NBA player and now motivational speaker, said something which resonated with me. And he said, it's interesting how society, and quite rightly so, is interested in what's affecting white working class boys. And there's a need to understand, but they don't seem to apply the same energy to want to understand what's happening with black working class boys and or working class boys of color. It's easy to criminalize them and push it to one side, but try to understand what's happening with white working class boys. So it got me thinking about black women and the common trope of all black women. This the one common trope everybody will recognize this is that they're angry black women. Whenever a black woman is passionate, she's angry. But nobody ever takes the time to understand how 300 years of forced labor, brutality, at a scale that you can't even begin to imagine, has had an effect on the people. we carry generational trauma. I heard a lot of women I've spoken to speak about this. And one of the things I wanted to talk about and what motivated me to write this piece was the generational trauma that's suffered by Black women. The plantations were known as slaughterhouses in the Caribbean. They were very brutal places in both the Caribbean and the US. Unspeakable horrors you can't even begin to imagine. And women and girls were raped repeatedly by those that owned them, by the men that worked for, like, you know, the slave handlers that worked for the owners. Women were just taken and raped. They were bred like cattle, babies ripped out of their arms and then given to somebody. They were seen as an animal to be bred. A cash cow, if you will. They were a reproductive unit. The more babies they had, the more money the master could make from that. And nobody ever. Now imagine you're in a situation where that's happening to you repeatedly. Then you're born, you know, then you have a child that's born into it and it happens to them. And if they manage to reach child rearing age, their child is born and it happens to them. And imagine that continues for generations. And then when slavery is over in 1833, and I say that with air quotes, that's the official date, but it lasted a lot longer, up until 1816, some in the British territories. But then you had 100+ years of subjugation. And then fast forward to now, instead of talking about the pain and the trauma that generations have suffered, we tell you to forget about it happened a long time ago. Or we tell you that you sold your own into slavery because we don't want to discuss it. Or, yeah, but this East African slavery was worse. We never want to talk about this. Can you imagine, you know, the need to never want to understand what these people have gone through? And to understand how people are today in the present, we have to look back at how they were in the past. And Britain does not want to acknowledge, and America, as we can see, is trying to expunge its past, banning African-American history in some states. Some books are being banned. The expunging of, you know, people of color in who are high achievers, Jackie Robinson being one of them, one of the first Black major baseball league players, and also a serviceman, the Tuskegee Airmen, etc. Totally expunged from memory, as if to say our contribution wasn't good. But then we suffered hundreds of years of brutality. And then I think what really, really tears into me is the word plantation has been sanitized. I don't know if you've seen Plantation Hotel and Plantation Rum. You know, plantations weren't a good place. Could you imagine someone having a hotel called Concentration Camp Hotel or Concentration Camp Rum? And let me tell you this, concentration camps were brutal. But the brutality that were on plantations was far worse. When you read some of the eyewitness accounts, there's one particular event where I'm going to get graphic here, just a trigger warning for those listeners. There's an instance where, and again, this is in a journal, a slave that ran away was captured. And they caught the slave and they tied the slave face down, star-shaped, spread apart. And they opened, the man's describing this, the owner. They slice open the back and spread the skin apart and spread honey on it. This was after whipping. They cut the skin open, spread honey, and allowed the flies to land on this person and leave the person there and left them there. And that was there, you know, and allowed animals to come and pick at them. And this was a slow, and that's just one instance. And again, the graphic, and we don't talk about this. This happened, and we carry a lot of this trauma inside us. There's a doctor called Arlene Geronimus, and she wrote a book called Weathering. And she talks about how generational trauma has an effect. When you live in an unjust society, it has an effect on your bodies. And it causes problems for you later on, like, you know, heart disease or blood pressure, or when you live in a society where you're constantly under attack, it has a problem. And she talks about generational trauma and how we carry it, and we've carried it for centuries, and she goes, we never talk about it, it's never discussed, it's just brushed off. Nobody gave, let's give these people, let's allow them to go and see a psychologist now to come out of slavery because it's been a tough time. We never got any of that, and we're still here, we're still fighting. But it's a part of history we have to discuss. And I feel the need now to talk about it more than ever, because I feel that the further we go, the more it's going to get airbrushed. I mean, you've seen the right wing have allowed this. You sold your own slaves into, they've allowed that one to take shape. And you even hear people like Suella Braverman and Kemi Badenoch not repeat that trope to give it validation. But I won't allow it to rest. Yeah. And this is my reason for talking about it.
And it also serves some of the examples that you gave as well. The horrific, inhumane examples that you gave also highlight just how closely connected politics, the politicization of race, and unfortunately profiteering has always been, and obviously still is. And I think that is further highlighted as well by the second post which you produced last week, which was the violence that built the plantation system.
That's correct. I think it's very triggering, because, you know, even though I wasn't there, I feel it, because, you know, people ask me, somebody asked me, how do you manage to write so well? I'm not a trained writer, but I've always said I believe the ancestors speak through me. I don't know how weird that sounds to people, but I do believe that, because I have these feelings and opinions inside me, and it's the only way I can explain it. And the plantations were run by fear. They wanted to create a culture where people didn't run away. They wanted to create a culture where people were not happy in their servitude, but certainly wouldn't leave their servitude for anything else. And the fear that gripped the plantations was the way that they treated the people who dared to look the owner in his eye, the master, or even didn't even pick enough cotton on that particular day, or enough cane if we're in the Caribbean. And that a person would be made an example of. And it was this fear that kept the plantations going for the time that they did.
Yeah, and you talk about also there were some horrific examples. We don't need to necessarily go into that at this stage, because I would really invite people to go and read the entire post, and also to stick with it and see what comes out next week as well. We cannot deny the relationship that exists between business and politics, unfortunately. To try to silence these voices that echo through the generations is simply an extension. And in some cases, I know that people have been brainwashed into thinking you have to separate politics from business. We always hear people say, oh, we don't talk about politics in our office because, it's uncomfortable and so on. Yeah, these are principles which have been more or less forced upon us in mild conversation, because really people don't want to face the issues that their companies have, the legacies of a lot of their companies. But unfortunately, by having this opinion, we are propagating white supremacy. Simple as that.
Absolutely. I think that's the problem. White supremacy is the problem. And, you know, what people have to understand is white supremacy, it's an ideology. When we say white supremacy, we're not talking about white people, but we're talking about the idea of whiteness, the idea of whiteness being the greatest, unmatched. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the idea that one group of people is far superior and better than all other group of peoples. And when you start stripping back the layers very slowly, what it reveals is that the world as we know it, the modern world, yes, we know it was created by Europeans, but the ideas and the ideas that they used to create the world, they didn't create themselves. They were ideas that were taken from elsewhere. This is the stuff that I'm getting to understand. And again, this isn't me saying this. You only have to look back at what was going on in ancient Egypt. Have a look what was going on in Greece and Turkey and in the Arab states, in China. Let's go back to the 1600s. If you look at Britain, just Britain alone, how was the country up until the 1600s? It was very basic, right? Nothing actually happened. Okay, nothing really happened. Things started to change after the 1600s. What was it that changed at that point? When they started building ships and traveling to other places. So the question that you have to ask yourself is, was it just they took a ship somewhere and came back and suddenly came up with all these ideas? Or did they actually see what was going on in these places and decided to adopt it themselves? Even the stars that we talk about, Galileo, and I believe the Greeks were mapping stars and the Egyptians were mapping stars thousands of years before Galileo got there. But again, the way the world works is only until the Europeans decide that they've, you know, seen it, that it gets a name, and then they put a name to it, saying that person invented it. In recent times, we've seen the discovery under the pyramids. I'm not sure if you've seen that. Have you seen these pylons that they found underneath? Have you seen this in recent
times? No.
It's a very new discovery, very, very new discovery. So you have to check this out, guys, if you're not seeing it. So this a few weeks back, they realized they use LIDAR, which is a...
Is it like a laser camera, essentially?
Yeah. Imaging. And what they found under the Great Pyramids are these pylons that go 2 kilometers down into the earth, 2 kilometers down. Wow. And they believed that these pylons were used to create energy. Right? Now, one of the things that we have been taught about Egypt is that the Egyptians were closer to whites, stroke Arabs, than they were to sub-Saharan Africans. Do you remember I shared with you a link with that guy from Africa?
Yeah.
He had the best minds about Egyptology in a room. Two black guys, and what the information that he presented said that the Egyptians, the early Egyptians, were sub-Saharan Africans.
Yeah.
Those in Egypt today can trace their lineage back to the Turks, the Greeks, and the Arabs. And even if you look at the map, the Europeans have redrawn the map of Africa. They've literally cut off North Africa, and they call it the Middle East now, because they are so hell-bent on separating the greatness of sub-Saharan Africa from the achievements in the world that they've gone to the lengths of redrawing the map and then renaming that part of Africa, the Middle East, and then telling you that the people that existed there when the pyramids built were the Arabs, stroke Greeks and Turks, and that they're more akin to Europeans, Northern Europeans, than they are to Africans, when in actual fact, the people from Kush and Nubia, which were next to Egypt, they were the originally Egyptians, and they were the pharaohs of the time. But again, we're not getting this discussion because there's this need to keep the ingenuity of blackness out of anything that was great in the world.
Yeah, and all of it comes down to, indeed, as you say, at some point, the insecurity of the elitist white supremacists of the time. And for some reason, generation after generation, this has become standard policy to push down any who are non, who don't perhaps pass that particular description characteristic.
Yeah.
And I still don't understand why it makes any sense, why we continue with this facade, but there it is.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think that they're so far down the rabbit hole now, so we have to continue. But I think that the world is one. You know, there's a saying that I have, and it goes like this, a lion needs to be massaged, right? It needs to be treated. It needs to be massaged and curated constantly. The truth only needs the light of day. And every day, what I'm learning is the truth is starting to appear now in all these areas. You know, the more people that get involved in areas of research that were traditionally considered for one particular group of people, i.e. areas of research where it's always been dominated by whites, and I'm talking about history, medicine, etc. The more and more people of color get involved in these areas, the more we'll see of the stuff that we that has been held from us. And this is what we're getting to see when we read Angela Sarney, when we read people like David Olusoga, and when we read Akala's natives, Sven Lindqvist.
And also women, of course, who for, you know, only recently have been allowed to go to university, have been allowed to hold high ed, you know, academic positions. I seriously do not believe that it is a coincidence that certain demographics have been kept down as much as possible. And we're still seeing this as well in the United States, that the new government is trying to find a way to take the vote away from millions of women. There is a reason for this.
Absolutely. I did actually write a piece a few weeks back on Substack, and it was about how the Europeans literally changed the way there was cultural suppression on the British rule was the title of the how the erasure of indigenous traditions. And what we found was that in my research, when you look at the places that Brits colonized, the British, the women that they met, or the women that they saw when they arrived, were women that were, they were hunters, they were gatherers. These women, they were politicians, they were astronomers. They did a lot of amazing things. When the British arrived in some of these places, they told them they couldn't do it, and subjugated the women to a position very much the same as the position that women had here at the time. So when we talk about equality for females, and the West likes to talk about itself being this feminist ideal and always has been, it hasn't. It's only been very recent that women were allowed to vote. I think it was only up until the 1960s that a woman was allowed to have her own bank account in Britain.
Yeah, and I think it was in the 1970s, even in some parts of Europe.
There you go. So that tells you a lot, right? So when I tell you all the bastions of feminism, and when I've traveled to West Africa, one of the things that really struck me was when they refer to the women as boss lady. That's how, in Gambia especially, this is how they refer to all the women, the wives, the sisters, or you have to ask boss lady. So are you the boss? Yes. And the respect level that I saw the men show the women made me start thinking a little bit about this, about the way that we view, you know, we seem to want to look down on other cultures and, you know, talking about ourselves in this position of morality. When in reality, we're following their lead, but we just don't know it.
Yep. And also, quite interestingly, this is yet another topic which a lot of companies are very uncomfortable with. But it has long since been recognized in businesses that women are underrepresented in the more senior positions. And in fact, there is a gross inequality, not just with regards to promotion avenues for women, but also with regards to the gender pay gap. And so therefore, this once again comes back to the topic that we're discussing at the head of it, which is basically how politics completely dominates business in every way. And yet for some reason, business still tries as hard as it can to push back against these open discussions.
I have some experience with this. So in my spare time, I do share action activism. So it's my job to attend, a part of this charity, it's my job to attend the annual general shareholders meetings. And this is where all the shareholders get to discuss, relay their concerns to the board members. So what this company, this charity does, it buys me one share, which allows me access, because you only need one share, you're a shareholder then. And then one of the areas that I have, the same area that I petition them on, is for them to improve first, the diversity on their boards and within the senior positions within the organization. That diversity means people of color and women. And I can tell you, I've been to about 30 meetings. I've only seen one brown face, no black faces. And I've probably seen about five or six women in 30 meetings. And the last meeting I went to was a brewery. Obviously, I won't mention their name, big brewery in the country, and they were very reluctant to do anything to improve diversity and refused to meet us.
Says a lot.
Yep, it does indeed. This is where we are. This is where we are. And what really bothers me is the line that people always use, oh, the best person for the job. That's the line that I often get. But I will say to people that it isn't always the best person that's in the job. It isn't. It, unfortunately, just because that person is there and dressed well, speaks well, and doing a good job doesn't mean that they're the best person for the job. If the best persons are not even being invited to an interview, how do we know that we've got the best pool of candidates in front of us if we're not looking at diversity? That a diverse company, you know, studies have shown, I can't remember the exact figures, if it's 20, 35% more profitable when you have a diverse board and diverse decision-making roles in an organization.
And when people talk about activism, when people say, okay, what can I do? You can start talking about these topics at work. You can start bringing them up in team meetings. You can start elevating them to discussions within senior partners within the organization. By introducing these topics at work, we can finally start to put pressure on businesses to do the right thing. Sometimes, in some cases, it can be dangerous. But if you get support of enough people around you, it's manageable.
That's correct. 100% correct. You activism is where it's in your everyday life, right? You see something you don't like and you want to make a change. You turn to the person who's closest to you, who's in authority or in a position to at least help you facilitate that change. It's part of your everyday life. You say at work, in your life, or a local high street store, there may not be access for disabled petition. This is where your activism is. It's in your everyday life.
Esheru, what can I say? We haven't done a podcast in a few weeks now, but yet you come up with a bang. A very emotional one today as well. People would not have noticed necessarily in the silences, but a lot of emotion as well. Thank you for talking about, you know, when people talk about trying to avoid talking about uncomfortable things, when you talk about something which triggers this kind of transgenerational emotion, that's not comfortable. I really don't think people realize you don't want to sit there every day remembering over and over again everything that has happened to your ancestors. You'd really like to be in a situation where you could look beyond that, but they don't realize that you have been forced, tasked to defend what your position is, because these kinds of inhuman cruelties are repeated on a daily basis.
Absolutely. For me, I want people to understand when they, you know, instead of looking at as a black person, I live in a society where the media is negative towards black people in many aspects, and there's a reason for that. And when I see young black boys out enjoying themselves, and, you know, there's always a negative connotation attached to them, and, you know, it's my job to correct that, you know, to get an understanding. Let's understand that, you know, the social indicators that we use to understand why, let's say, a group of white people are affected by things in society are the exact same social indicators as to why a group of black people are affected by certain things in society. There's no difference. And let's understand that they've got the same problems, and it needs a collective approach, not singling out one group and wanting to understand that group whilst pushing the other group and saying they're a problem, let's forget about them. It doesn't solve the challenges that we have.
No, unfortunately it doesn't. And so therefore, certain voices will remain loud, voices will remain consistent, and those voices will grow. And you're one of those voices, and a powerful one at that. So, yeah, I thank you, Esheru, for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Two and a mic.